behind her, wondering where he would have hidden that key, and how she will ever find it. She goes up to Peter's old room, where James is sleeping peacefully, surrounded by pillows to keep him from falling off the bed. She watches the small mound of his body rise and fall with every sweet breath, and she's overcome with a powerful swell of love and inexplicable optimism. This spirit of resilience was inherited from her father, a man who never gave up. A man who endured and persevered, snatching handfuls of pleasure whenever he could. Chapter 41. The sunlight spilling through the gauzy curtains gently wakes her. Everything from the day before slowly comes back. The funeral, her conversation with Clémentine. Maggie stretches, rolls onto her side, and curls up against Gabrielle. He presses her hand to his chest, and she can feel his heart beating beneath her palm.
"I want you to move to Gaspé with me,"
he says, his voice hoarse from sleep.
"I bought that land for us, Maggie. That's why I came back. For a fresh start."
"I can't just leave."
"Gaspésie is the most beautiful place," he says, turning around to face her. "It's the best of both worlds, countryside by the sea."
"My life is here."
"You can translate books anywhere."
"My father left me the business," she tells him. "And I want to run it. I've always wanted to." Gabrielle sighs and flops onto his back. "You completely disappeared from my life," she says. "You can't just come back a year later and expect me to give up everything. I want to be with you, but here."
"I want to raise my son," he says, lighting a cigarette. "A boy needs his father in his life. My land is on the water. I can teach him to fish."
"Fatherhood is more than fishing."
"I know that."
"You don't understand," she says. "I want to stay here and run my father's seed store. I was always meant to do it. I'll be good at it."
"How can you work and take care of James?"
"I'll find a way," she says. "Violet has offered to help me."
"We're a family, Maggie. We should be together."
"You mean where you want to be?"
"I love you," he says. "I always have. God damn it, Maggie. Have some faith in us and choose me over your father."
The baby lets out a cry from his nursery, and Gabrielle instinctively jumps out of bed to get him.
"You can't smoke while you're holding him," Maggie scolds.
"Why not?"
"It's not healthy. It's bad for his lungs."
"Says who?"
"He was premature. His lungs are fragile."
Gabrielle stubs out the cigarette and leaves the room, returning moments later with James in his arms.
"Do you want to come live in Gaspésie, little man?"
he asks the baby, kissing his head and cheeks.
A breeze comes in through the open window, rustling the eyelet curtains and blowing Maggie's translation notes off her bedside table and onto the floor like softly falling leaves. She crouches down to pick them up, grateful for something to do. But when she's got them all back in order on the table, she allows herself a quick glance at Gabrielle. He caresses his son's fine hair.
"Isn't it strange, Maggie, how you miscarried all your husband's babies, but mine is the only one that survived? How can we not believe this is right?"
"I can't move to Gaspé."
"Everything that ever got in the way is behind us," he tells her. "Your father is gone. You don't need his approval anymore. Let go of his plan for your life already, Maggie."
"That's what you don't understand," she says. "Running the store is my plan for life. It always has been." Gabrielle looks unconvinced. "It hasn't only been about pleasing him," she states, with more clarity than she's felt in a long time. Her reason for staying now is to fulfill her life's purpose, not her father's.
"You belong here too," she says. "You just won't admit it."
"I've already bought the land, Maggie. I have a good job."
"Then you can see James whenever you visit."
"So you've made up your mind," he says, staring at his son.
"Haven't you?"
She turns away, not sure she can withstand another ending. After all this time, neither one of them is prepared to make the sacrifice to be together.
Gabrielle wants to be with her on his terms, on his turf, which is exactly what she's always wanted from him. She realizes, as he hands the baby over to her, that she feared it would end this way the moment she opened her door to him. When it's really mattered, neither one of them has ever been able to commit to the other. Maybe love doesn't always prevail over who a person is at the core. He pulls on his black pants from the funeral, buttons up his white shirt and stuffs his tie in his pocket without saying a word. "Gabrielle," she says, "before you go back to Gaspé, there's something I'd like us to do together." Chapter 42. It's Sunday morning, sunny and cold. Maggie looks out the window at San Nazarius Hospital and knows it's a long shot. All she got from the government in response to her inquiries was the official copy of Elodie's record of transfer from October 1957, confirming that she was one of dozens of girls between the ages of 7 and 12, transferred to an unnamed institution in Montreal that year. After doing some research, Maggie was able to narrow down the three primary hospitals that bore the brunt of most of those transfers, one of which was San Nazarius. Maggie and Gabrielle went to Mercy Hospital first, an unpleasant experience in which they were rebuked and stonewalled by a team of nuns, and Maggie made to feel like a criminal for having gotten pregnant at 15. Afterwards, Maggie understood how Clémentine must have felt in her own hometown. San Nazarius is set back on a vast campus, surrounded by at least a dozen separate pavilions. The main entrance is housed in a stately gray stone building, U-shaped, with endless rows of white dormer windows. The center of the main building resembles a church, with two stone pillars on either side and a prominent cross on the roof.
"Ready?"
She looks over at Gabrielle and gives him an unconvincing nod. They get out of the car and he reaches for her hand. They enter through the front gate and approach the building in silence. The psychiatric pavilion, with its barred windows, cavernous hallways, and strong stench of bleach, gives Maggie a terrible feeling of dread. She does a full sweep of the floor, which is ominously clean and quiet, and wonders where the children are. At the front desk, Maggie introduces them as the parents of an orphan who might have been transferred here in 57. She was born on March 6, 1950. The nun, thin-lipped and bespectacled, cuts Maggie off.
"I can't help you," she says. "All the patient's records are sealed."
"I have her record of transfer," Maggie says, retrieving it from her purse and holding it out to the nun. "I know most of the orphans from outlying towns were sent here or to..."
"You gave her up, did you not?"
"Yes, sister, I did, but I was 16 at the time," Maggie explains. "I'm in a position to take care of her now."
"The records are sealed, madame. You gave up your rights to them."
"But if she's here," Maggie says, her voice rising, "isn't it the best possible outcome for all of us if we take her home?"
"Can't you check the records?"
Gabrielle intervenes.
"And tell us if she's here."
"We know the exact date she was transferred," Maggie adds, pointing to the record of transfer.
"You're wasting your time, madame."
"But we're her parents," Maggie cries, losing control. "Besides, this barbaric experiment is about to come to an end anyway. Dr. Lazure has already declared that the orphans don't belong in mental hospitals."
"It doesn't work that way," the nun interrupts. "We still have laws in Quebec. If the girl was ever here, it's because she's mentally deficient."
Gabrielle places his hand on Maggie's forearm to calm her. "Can't you just confirm if she's here or not, or if she ever was?" Maggie pleads, softening her tone. "A quick peek at her file?"
"I will not,"
the nun snips indignantly. Gabrielle is glaring at Maggie, silently admonishing her to keep her cool. She ignores him.
"I will come back with a lawyer if I have to,"
Maggie threatens as another nun approaches the desk. She's short and broad-shouldered, with a round face and wide-set brown eyes.
"Hello,"
she says warmly, taking over from her colleague.
"My name is Sister Ignacia. Is there something I can help you with? I'm one of the ward supervisors."
Her friendly demeanor immediately puts Maggie at ease. "Yes, sister," she says, relieved. Thank you. I'm looking for my daughter, Elodie. She was transferred here in 57.
An unmistakable flash of recognition crosses Sister Ignatia's eyes. Both Maggie and Gabrielle catch it and exchange hopeful looks.
Elodie de Saint-Sulpice,
Sister Ignatia says, and the other nun gives her a sharp look.
Yes,
Maggie cries, her heart pounding.
I knew little Elodie.
Maggie's heart stops.
Knew?
She manages.
She was 7 when she was transferred here.
Yes,
Gabrielle says.
She's not here anymore. Was she adopted?
Elodie was very sick when she got here,
Sister Ignatia explains.
She died not long after. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you.
Maggie collapses against Gabrielle. She feels his hand enclosing hers, hears the nun saying something about Elodie being very weak from birth. All Maggie can think is that she failed her daughter.
I can make you copies from our file,
Sister Ignatia offers.
When Maggie doesn't respond, Gabrielle says, Yes, please. That's very kind.
Sister Ignatia disappears down the hall, her shoes squeaking on the linoleum, her habits sweeping behind her. They wait about 20 minutes in bereaved silence before she returns with a San Azarius envelope. Maggie numbly opens it and glances down at some of the scribbled notes. Even through the blur of tears, some of the words leap off the page. Profound mental retardation, danger to herself and others, paranoid delusions, violent outbursts and convulsions. Influenza. The diagnosis is signed by someone at the Hôpital Mental Saint-Sulpice. The name is illegible. A scribble.
She wasn't mentally retarded, Maggie says, looking up.
Sister Ignatia smiles sympathetically, but doesn't say anything. Her look, full of pity and recrimination, says plenty.
This can't be right, Maggie says.
Is it possible there's been an error, a mix-up?
I knew her, madame,
Sister Ignatia says softly.
She had many problems. Not only health issues, but grave mental and emotional problems too. Those notes were written by a doctor.
Where's the death certificate? Maggie wants to know. There's nothing in the file after 1957. Not even a mention of her death.
If there was a death certificate, Sister Ignatia responds calmly. The government would have it.
What do you mean, if?
Your daughter was mentally deficient and born out of wedlock,
Sister Ignatia says gently, her voice as sweet as syrup.
It's unlikely there's any record of her death, let alone her life.
Other than what you're holding in your hand.
Outside, Maggie picks up a rock and throws it at the hospital's brick facade.
I don't believe her,
she says, turning to Gabrielle.
Maggie,
my daughter is not dead.
I'm going to write to the government and request her death certificate. He pulls her close and tries to hold her, but she fights him off.
I'm not just giving up.
That nun has no reason to lie, Gabrielle says softly. It's time to let go.
I'm not letting go, Maggie states. I don't believe that woman. She had a sinister face.
I guess that you need to keep believing.
My daughter is alive, and I'm going to find her.
Chapter 43 Elodie 1961 One afternoon in the final days of winter, when the outside world is gray and colorless through the barred windows, and all the snow has melted, Elodie is called away from her sewing machine in the middle of her shift. She gets up from the singer and follows one of the nuns down the corridor in silent consternation. Swoosh, swoosh. She will never forget the portentous sound of the nuns' habits sweeping the floor. They go up the 6 flights of stairs to the main lobby of the mental ward. But instead of going through the locked doors that lead to Elodie's ward, the nun stops in front of one of the offices and knocks.
Entrez,
comes a man's voice. The nun opens the door and gently nudges Elodie into the room.
Elodie de Saint-Sulpice, she says,
before disappearing,
I'm Dr. Lazur,
the man says, reaching for a file on the desk, barely looking up.
Sit, please.
Elodie doesn't move. As she realizes what's happening, her body goes numb.
I won't bite, he says.
She opens her mouth to speak, but nothing comes. She's frozen. Whatever she says and does in this office will decide her fate. She messed up last time. She said the wrong things, and they thought she was dumb or retarded or difficult. Whatever mistake she made, it ruined her life. She can't let it happen again. The doctor is watching her. She feels herself trembling. Still, she can't budge.
There's nothing to be scared of, he says.
He seems kind enough, but she knows better than to trust him. Twice she's been fooled by doctors. Both times she paid dearly for her poor judgment.
Sit,
he repeats, more firmly. Finally, her legs move and she does as she's told.
I'm part of a psychiatric team investigating institutions like San Nazarius,
he explains.
We're examining hundreds of children like you.
Why?
Because we're part of a commission tasked with determining whether or not you and others like you belong in a place like this.
What's a commission?
Elodie asks, and then regrets it immediately. Terrified, he's going to think she doesn't know anything, that she's retarded or ignorant, like Sister Camille said.
It's a duty or a project assigned to a group of people.
He answers neutrally.
I don't work at this hospital, you see. This isn't my office. I'm just visiting. I'm here to ask you some questions.
She nods, taking a nervous breath. She notices the file in front of him and can't help but stare at it. It's her file. She can see the numbers 3650 on the front cover, and recognizes them as her date of birth.
Shall we start?
He asks her.
Yes, monsieur.
Remember, I'm here as an ally.
She has no idea what that means. Ally. But this time she doesn't dare say so.
How long have you been here, Elodie?
4 years, she says.
And before that?
The orphanage.
And you're now?
11,
she says tentatively, wondering if it's a trick question.
It's not a test,
he says, reading her mind.
Elodie, do you know why you're here at San Nazarius?
No, sir.
He scribbles something in her file.
Because the doctor from the orphanage thought I was retarded,
she ventures.
Or crazy?
Dr. Lazur continues scribbling in her file.
On change of vocation day, she explains. Sister Tata told us we were all mentally retarded, but me and Emeline and a couple of other girls, we were the only ones sent here to San Nazarius. So we must have done something wrong.
Dr. Lazur looks up at her, but doesn't say anything.
I'm not retarded,
Elodie says, her voice rising.
I don't belong in here.
I don't disagree with that.
I'm an orphan, she tells him. Not a mental patient. Sister Camille says I'm backwards from being here so long, but that doesn't mean I'm crazy.
Indeed not.
So I may not know all the answers to the questions you're going to ask me, she says. But I'm not crazy.
Dr. Lazur nods, frowning. She can't tell if she's displeased him or said something wrong. Shut up, she silently reprimands herself.
I didn't know the answers to the other doctor's questions, and that's why they sent me here. But I was only 7.
This isn't a test you can fail.
Isn't it?
She says.
I want to get out of here. I have to.
I understand.
She shakes her head.
No, you don't.
Tell me, he says.
They killed my friend, she blurts. Emeline de Saint-Sulpice. We came here together. She wasn't the first one they killed either.
Elodie stops and covers her mouth with her hand. She's done it again, said too much. The kind of reckless babbling that already got her into terrible trouble with Sister Ignatia.
What if this doctor tells on her like the last one did?
That's a very serious accusation, Dr. Lazure says.
It's true, though,
Elodie continues, unable to stop herself.
They gave Emmeline an overdose of Lagactyl. Another girl was killed for singing. They weren't retarded either. They were just orphans like me.
Dr. Lazure is nodding. There's a deep crease between his eyes. Elodie knows she's made another serious mistake. She looks down at the floor, trying to hide her trembling lip and tears. After a moment in which the crease in Dr. Lazio's forehead softens, he says,
Can you tell me what this is, dear?
He holds up a picture of what looks like a box with knobs.
No, sir,
she responds.
It's a radio, he tells her. What about this?
No, sir.
It's an accordion. And this?
A car,
she says, recognizing it at once. He holds up more pictures of different objects, asking her what each one is. She knows some, but not all.
This is a refrigerator,
he tells her when she fails to guess. This is a pineapple, a telephone, a present, a tractor, a heart.
It's just like last time,
she interrupts, her voice breaking.
I've never seen these things, but it doesn't make me crazy.
Of course not, he agrees.
I'm ignorant, she tells him. That's all.
He smiles sadly and writes something in her file.
If you're letting us out of here, she says, do you think you can arrange for me to go back to Saint-Sulpice, in case my mother comes back for me?
His expression clouds. He looks away, avoiding her.
That's all for today, he says.
She sits there for a moment, not wanting to leave without something concrete to latch onto. A promise or some shred of hope to get her through the remainder of her days here.
I don't belong here.
He nods in response and gets up from the table. The days trickle by lethargically, each one gloomier than the one before. Girls from Elodie's ward start disappearing, but she remains. Sister Camille assures her that her day will come, but she's beginning to wonder. The older girls, the ones who are 18, 19, in their early 20s, are being sent out into the world with a single suitcase and a prayer. They'll have to find work and places to live, a mandate that to Elodie seems insurmountable given their limited skills and knowledge about the world. Elodie is grateful she's only 11.
What do you think you're doing?
Elodie's head snaps up to find Sister Ignatia standing above her.
I'm just sitting here rocking,
Elodie responds. Her tone slightly more defiant than usual.
The toilets and floors in your dormitory bathroom need scrubbing, Sister Ignatia says, her black eyes hard. Now that Yvette is gone, it's your job.
I already have a job.
The back of Sister Ignatia's hand lands squarely against Elodie's temple before she can finish her sentence. Elodie clutches her head to stop the ringing in her ears. She can feel hot tears burning her eyes.
When I get out of here...
You're not getting out, Sister Ignatia interrupts.
I'm an orphan,
Elodie says, emboldened.
That's why the doctor interviewed me.
And where do you think you're going to go?
Back to a real orphanage or a foster home. Somewhere my mother can find me.
Your mother's dead,
Sister says, her tone almost triumphant. Elodie feels her pulse start to pound.
No, she's not,
she says, her voice a tremor.
You're just saying that.
Sister Ignatia's expression is void of pity.
It's in your file.
I don't believe you,
Elodie manages, her mouth dry. Sister Ignatia turns suddenly and leaves the room. Elodie rocks back and forth, trying to calm down. Could it be true? Her mother dead? The girl in the rocking chair beside her, one of the real mental patients, lets out a loud yelp.
Shut up,
Elodie mutters. The girl yelps again, baring her teeth like an animal.
I said shut up,
Elodie cries, tears spilling down her cheeks. The retarded girl grunts something and whimpers. The next thing Elodie knows, Sister Ignatia is back, waving a file in her face.
Here,
she says, holding it up. Just so you know, once and for all.
Sister opens the file.
Mother deceased,
she reads aloud, and then she turns it so Elodie can see for herself. Elodie can make out the word mother, but the other word, deceased, is just random letters. She doesn't remember how to read very well.
She's dead, sister says. She died in childbirth, God's punishment for her sins. You have no father. You're a bastard, and you've nowhere else to go. You're too young to go out on your own, and too old for an orphanage or a foster family. No one wants a pubescent girl. You've fallen between the cracks, so this is where you'll be staying.
It's not true,
Elodie says, her voice catching. Sister Ignatia smirks.
It's right here, she says,
pointing to the elegant script, permanently recorded in black ink.
Mère décédée.
Mother deceased.
But you've never said so before.
I'm saying so now.
Chapter 44. Maggie. Maggie steps inside the seed store and turns on the lights. She hasn't felt up to being here since her father died, but tonight she was inspired to come back and reconnect with him. She looks around with a stab of grief. Her father will never set foot in here again, never roam the floor or ring up a sale, or engage in another political debate with the French farmers he derided and adored so much. It's Maggie's place now. She passes the bins of seeds on her way to the attic, stopping to open one of the drawers and let a handful of Indian strawberries slide through her fingers. Then she climbs the stairs, thinking how one day James will weigh the seeds on Saturdays, just like she did. Upstairs it's unchanged. The scale, the stack of tiny yellow envelopes, the metal scoop. She gazes out into the alley, remembering who she was back then. The pubescent girl with high ambitions and a crush on Daddy's worst nightmare. Even the smell is the same. Damp earth. Mildew. She goes back downstairs to her father's office, which is now hers. The place where her father agonized over his bills, tallied his invoices, ordered the seeds. Where Maggie caught him with Clementine. She sits down at the big desk. There are neat piles of file folders laid out for her. Accounts payable, inventory, overdue invoices, orders pending. Tomorrow she will meet with the store manager to review her father's systems and learn the ropes. He's the one who's been in charge while her father was at home dying. He's the one who's kept the business organized and afloat. Maggie will have to be careful not to step on his toes, or anyone else's. Her biggest challenge will be the saleswoman. One of the last things her father said to her was, "If you decide to stay and run the store, do it with humility. Give them all time to adjust to you." A funny thing to say, coming from him. Humility was never his strong suit, but she understood it would have to be hers if she was going to earn the respect of her employees and her customers. Sitting here now, with the reality of the task laid out before her, she feels nervous and slightly sick. What if she fails? What if the business goes bankrupt in her inexperienced hands? She reminds herself that her father had enough faith in her to leave his most prized possession in her care. She has a mind for business, and she's always loved the challenge. And now she's poised to take it over before the age of 30. She opens the top drawer of his desk, which smells musty, like wet wood. And there in the otherwise empty drawer is a seed envelope with her name on it. Maggie. Written in her father's neat, square handwriting. She opens the envelope. Inside, she finds the key to his filing cabinet with a short note. "You were always my wildflower." She wastes no time getting back to Dunham. The house is dark and everyone is asleep. She quietly lets herself into her father's sanctuary and opens the filing cabinet. In the bottom drawer, she discovers a neatly folded white flannel baby blanket. As she unfolds it, she sees the words, "Property of Brougham Missisquoi Perkins Hospital," printed on the fabric. She shakes it out, and a tiny plastic hospital bracelet lands in her lap. There's no name on it, only a date. 3-6-50. She presses the blanket to her nose and smells it. Elodie's blanket. Her father was more sentimental than she realized. Beneath the blanket, there's a large manila envelope from Sunny Goldbaum. She sits cross-legged on the floor and tears open the envelope. There's a birth record from Brome Missisquoi Perkins Hospital, and a number of letters on thin blue stationery. From the desk of Sunny H. Goldbaum. September 9th, 1949. Thank you for driving into the city for our appointment, Mr. Hughes. It was a pleasure to meet you. I will start my search immediately for a suitable placement. Please keep me informed as to the progress of your daughter's pregnancy, health, due date, etc. As per our conversation, the adoptive family will be Jewish. But rest assured, the families I agree to represent are of the very highest caliber. December 12th, 1949. Good news, Mr. Hughes. I found a young couple thrilled to adopt your daughter's baby. They have not been able to conceive and have had a difficult time going through the usual channels. You are helping to make their dreams come true. They have agreed to your fee. I will be in touch with more details. How is the pregnancy progressing? February 4th, 1950. Mr. Hughes, here are the logistics. You will deliver the infant to Sister Jeanne Edmour at Mercy Hospital. She will bring the infant to me. You will be paid in advance, as will the doctor and nun at Mercy. No money is to be exchanged between you and any of the parties. You will not see the adoptive parents or know their names. It's understood there is to be no contact. March 18th, 1950. Mr. Hughes, I have not succeeded in convincing the couple to take the baby, due to her poor health. I will continue my search for a new placement, though as per our earlier conversation, the jaundice and low birth weight are both obstacles. I will keep you informed. Maggie shifts through the correspondence and finds a yellowed newspaper clipping from La Presse, dated February 1954. Montreal lawyer Sonny Hyman Goldbaum was taken into custody yesterday and arraigned on charges of falsifying birth certificates and giving counsel in an indictable offense, in association with an international ring dealing in black market babies. Goldbaum, 31, pleaded not guilty to the charges. But evidence so far reveals that more than 1,000 French-Canadian babies born in Montreal have been sold illegally to Jewish families in the United States. According to sources, a family wishing to adopt a child in New York would contact a lawyer there who would then refer them to Goldbaum. Once the financial details were agreed upon, the ring would obtain a baby from a home for unwed mothers, with or without the birth mother's consent. The baby would then be delivered to its destination with a falsified visa and passport. More arrests are expected in what sources describe as a multi-million dollar ring of doctors, lawyers, nurses, and others. Maggie rifles through the filing cabinet and retrieves the remaining items her father left for her. Among them, some business books, The Entrepreneur's Bible, Drucker's The Practice of Management, Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, as well as some gardening books and old catalogs, and an essay Maggie wrote in third grade. The person I admire most. My father is called the seed man in town because he has the largest selection of seeds in the eastern townships. His store is called Semences Supérieures, Superior Seeds. The sign is written in French and English. Sniffling and wiping tears, she comes upon the galleys of her first translation, We Shall Overcome. When she reaches for one of the gardening books, Wildflowers of Eastern Canada, she discovers pressed between its pages the dried rosinweed flowers she gave her father the day she moved to Montreal. She remembers him setting the bouquet down on the front counter of the store and thinking he would forget about them. She presses Elodie's blanket to her face and pulls her knees to her chest. Sitting amidst the precious tokens and mementos her father saved for her over the years, Maggie realizes just how much he really loved her. He didn't often express it, or even seem to approve of her. But her findings today prove otherwise. Flipping once more through the worn pages of the wildflower book, Maggie comes upon two envelopes tied together with an elastic band, both addressed to Wellington Hughes in swirling, old-fashioned script. She opens one of them, and a small black-and-white photograph slips out onto the floor, of a little girl standing in the middle of someone's backyard. She has a bowl haircut and is wearing a pinafore dress with saddle shoes. She's holding a bedraggled baby doll in one hand and what looks like a drawing in the other. The date on the white border of the photograph is June 17th, 1953. Maggie stares at the picture for a moment, then pulls out the letter. Dear Monsieur Hughes, the child you and your wife have expressed interest in is a bright, friendly girl who has been with us since birth. She is in perfect health, progressing nicely through all the milestones. As you requested, I am enclosing a photograph. If you would like to visit her again, we would be happy to welcome you at your convenience and discuss possible arrangements for her adoption. Sincerely, Sister Alberta. Maggie reaches numbly for the other letter, which is dated November 1955. Monsieur Hughes, you may not be aware that as a result of a recent government mandate, the former Saint-Sulpice orphanage is now L'Hôpital Mental Saint-Sulpice. The child to whom you are referring is no longer here. I'm not at liberty to disclose any other information. Sincerely, Sister Alberta. It takes Maggie a little while to absorb what she's just found. She returns to the photograph, staring at that little girl in awe. Her daughter. All at once, the pieces fall into place. Her father not only found Elodie, but also visited her at the orphanage and pretended to want to adopt her so he could find out... what? That she was alive, healthy, progressing nicely through all the milestones? Was he merely curious about her, or had he been in search of some solace or reassurance that she was okay, to assuage his own guilt? Once he had seen her for himself and he was satisfied that she was thriving and would likely get adopted, he seems to have abandoned interest in her until 1955, right around the time the orphanages were converted to mental hospitals.
I'm sorry I didn't save her when I could.
He'd tried to get her back, but it was too late. She'd already been declared a mental patient. Sister Alberta lied in the letter. Elodie wasn't transferred until 1957. Were they all liars, those nuns? Destroying the lives of helpless children to make as much money off them as possible, and protect the church at the same time? Maggie clutches the picture of her daughter to her chest and folds herself over it, crying softly. A knock on the door startles her. She gets up, wipes her nose and eyes, and crosses the kitchen to find Gabrielle standing outside.
What are you doing here?
She asks him, unlocking the door and letting him in.
I went to your house and you weren't there. I figured you'd be here.
The door closes behind him and he follows her back to her father's office.
You look like you've been crying, he says,
touching her cheek.
It's been a hard week for you.
You could say that.
She looks away so he won't see a fresh outpouring of tears.
I'm not sure how long it will take me, he says.
How long what will take you?
She asks him.
To quit my job, pack up my things and sell my land.
She looks up at him, confused. Sell your land? He nods.
But you love your job, she says. You love the seaside.
I can fish here, Maggie. It's just land. I want to be with you, and I want to raise our son. I've thought of nothing else since I got here.
Really?
We belong together, here in the townships, just like you said. We always did.
Without a word, she falls into him, sobbing.
Are these happy tears?
He asks her, brushing her hair from her face. Maggie pulls away and hands him the photograph.
What's this?
It's a picture of Elodie, she says. I found it in my father's things. There was a letter, too. Gabrielle, she wasn't sick.
He looks confused.
That nun at Saint-Nazarius lied to us. Look.
She gives him the letter to read for herself.
Elodie was never sick, she says fiercely,
reading it over his shoulder.
The government has no death certificate. Why would we believe she's dead?
Chapter 45. Elodie. 1967. Elodie is lying awake on her cot, looking up at the ceiling she's come to despise. It doesn't matter that Ward A is called the Freedom Ward, and living here is a huge improvement over Ward B. She still hates every square inch of this hospital. And although life on Ward A, where she's been since 1964, has afforded her more freedom to come and go within the hospital, more independence and no more physical abuse, San Azayus remains what it has always been for her. A prison. Tonight is her last night in this prison. Sister Camille has arranged for her to share an apartment with another San Azayus girl, who's been out on her own for almost a year. The girl, Marie-Claude, currently rents a 1.5-room basement apartment in Pointe-Saint-Charles. Melody remembers her from San Azayus, a tall, quiet girl whose accommodating, subservient disposition spared her at least some of the torture and punishment suffered by the others. Marie-Claude and Elodie were not exactly friends, but they knew each other from Ward B and coexisted without incident. Elodie rolls onto her side and closes her eyes. Tomorrow she will walk out of this place into her future. As surreal as it feels, her dominant emotion tonight is fear. The truth is she'd almost rather stay here. Almost. She knows what to expect here, what's expected of her. There's a certain simple rhythm to her days, a familiarity and predictability she's not quite ready to leave. Who knows what awaits her out there in the world? After Sister Camille found her a place to live in the city, the medical superintendent at San Azarius invited Elodie into his office and tried to convince her to stay.
"What can you possibly do in the world?"
he asked her. She shrugged. She had no idea. He offered her a private room, not on the mental ward, and a job with pay at the hospital pharmacy, and the freedom to come and go as she pleased. It was a tempting offer, and Elodie promised to think about it, which she did. His question plagued her for days. What can you possibly do in the world? She has no education, no skills, no money, no family or friends. Aside from the orphanage and a couple of outings by bus into a nearby town, she's never left the San Azarius grounds. She's been institutionalized since the age of 5, most of her 17 years. At least here she has Sister Camille. Sister Camille has become her best friend, advocate, and confidant. The one who taught her to read again by practicing with the Bible. The one who got her transferred to Ward A. And now the one to set her free. What if the real world is no better than San Azarius? Certainly she won't be able to hide her stupidity and lack of experience. And everyone will know she's grown up in a mental hospital. When the sun finally rises in the west window of her dorm, Elodie rises with it. She removes the small suitcase Sister Camille gave her last night from beneath her cot and lays it on the mattress, taking care not to wake the others. Into it she neatly places her 2 dresses, nightgowns, undergarments, and socks, all donated over the years, and the Bible Sister Camille gave her. She pads softly to the washroom to change out of her nightgown, brush her teeth and hair, gaze at herself one last time in the chipped mirror above the porcelain sink. The girl she sees staring back at her fills her with self-loathing. Her short, bobbed hair lies flat and colorless against her scalp. Her skin is sallow, her eyes lifeless. That's the first thing people will notice, that she looks crazy. She adds her nightgown and toiletries to the suitcase and closes it. "You should be happy today," she tells herself. "This is the day you've dreamt of your whole life." She pulls the blanket up over her bed and has one last look around the room. The corridors are quiet. Elodie half hopes one of the nuns will appear so she can look her in the eye and say, "None of you will ever tell me what to do again." But not one of the sisters shows up to see her off. In some ways, this final display of indifference is almost as upsetting as some of the crueler punishments she endured. She contemplates dashing over to Ward B to bid Sister Ignatia a triumphant goodbye and then spit in her face. But she wisely concludes that Sister Ignatia would probably have her thrown in a cell and locked up, left to rot. With that in mind, Elodie hurries to the stairwell. Downstairs in the lobby, she remembers the night she first arrived, how terrified she'd been, how unsuspecting. Throwing open the doors, she steps outside into the cold morning, gasping for breath. She squints against the brightness of the sun reflecting off the snow. "I'm free."
"Hello?"
It's Sister Camille, waving from the car. Elodie buttons her coat to the neck. She's forgotten how cold the winter days can be. She hasn't been on an excursion in a long time, and they were usually in the summer. How will she afford to buy a hat? Mittens? Her chest tightens just thinking about it. The practical things of life. She doesn't look behind her as she walks down the steps.
Hello! Hurry up!
Sister Camille is waving. Her brother is waiting in the driver's seat to take them to Pointe Saint-Charles.
Are you ready?
She asks. Elodie swallows. She knows this is Sister Camille's day off, and she's grateful to her, but she can't find the words to express it. She's 17 years old and broken. She isn't ready to face the world at all. As the car pulls away, she weeps.
Cry,
Sister Camille tells her, reaching around to take her hand.
Cry all you like.
And she does, loudly and without restraint, as they drive off into the bewildering unknown. Chapter 46. Her new home is in the basement of a flat, red-brick row house on Rue de la Congrégation, in an industrial part of the city.
You're going to like it here,
Sister Camille says, trying to fill the silence with her usual bubbles of optimism.
There's a park nearby,
Sister Camille's brother adds.
Right there on the corner of Wellington and Liverpool.
Wellington and Liverpool?
Elodie repeats in broken English.
It's mostly Irish around here.
And French, too,
Sister Camille adds, glaring at her brother.
Griffintown on the other side of the canal is all Irish, but don't worry. Here in the Pointe, there are just as many French.
Elodie stares out the window. The neighborhood beyond her street is a mix of factories, row houses, looming smokestacks.
There's still work being done for the new metro, Sister Camille explains. That's why there's so much debris from the construction.
The metro?
It's an underground train. They're building it for the World Expo this summer.
Sister Camille may as well be speaking a different language. Underground train? World Expo? Elodie is staring at her, fighting back tears.
We can tell you all about that when you're settled, Sister Camille says. Don't worry, Elo. It will get easier.
Elodie nods, not believing her.
The city is blossoming, Sister Camille goes on. It's a wonderful time to live here. Just wait till summer.
Elodie forces a smile. She can see how hard Sister Camille is trying.
I like it, she says, staring at the red row house.
The rent is $74 a month, including heat, of which Elodie will pay half.
Let's go inside,
she says, taking a breath.
And it's yours, Sister Camille reminds her. You don't have to answer to anyone, except God.
Elodie ignores the remark. She doesn't have a sense of humor about God. Marie-Claude is waiting for her inside. The apartment is clean and sparse. One room with a pull-out couch and a dresser for them to share. A tiny bathroom and a kitchenette with just enough room for a square table and two fold-up chairs.
It's not much, Marie-Claude apologizes. But it's better than Saint-Nazarius.
Elodie smiles and sets down her suitcase.
Here,
Sister Camille says, handing her a note. Elodie opens it.
Dominion Textiles?
They're hiring sewers, she explains. I saw the sign in the window. The factory's in Saint-Henri.
Isn't that where the FLQ guy got blown up last summer?
Marie-Claude says.
Blown up?
Elodie repeats, feeling faint.
He was trying to blow up the Dominion Textile factory, but his bomb detonated.
Why would he do that?
He was FLQ. Marie-Claude says. The terrorists who want Quebec to separate from Canada, so they attack English companies like Dominion Textiles.
Elodie looks nervously at Sister Camille.
They still need sewers, Sister Camille says firmly. It won't happen again, not there anyway. It's perfect for you. Saint-Henri is easy to get to from the Pointe.
How will I get there? Elodie wants to know. Sister Camille sighs.
You'll figure it out, Elo. You're not helpless.
I am, though, she cries. That's exactly what I am.
Sister Camille looks her in the eyes.
You don't have to be, she says.
You're free now.
That's easy for you to say, Elodie mutters. You must forgive the other nuns, Sister Camille says sharply. Some of us had 50 children to look after with no help. The decent among us were forbidden to treat you with kindness or affection. But we weren't all bad.
Elodie looks down at the ground.
I'm sorry, she murmurs. You've been so good to me, and I have no way to repay you.
Repay me by forgiving the others.
Elodie holds her tongue. She will never forgive the others, least of all Sister Ignatia. But she won't disappoint Sister Camille by saying so.
I have to go, Sister Camille says.
Already?
Sister Camille pulls Elodie into her arms and hugs her, a short, quick embrace, and then hands her some money.
To tide you over, she says. I'll be back in 1 week.
And then she leaves the two girls to their new life.
It doesn't take more than a minute before Elodie bursts into tears again.
Marie-Claude hands her a tissue.
I was the same way when I first got out, she says,
sitting down on the couch.
I couldn't stop crying. How am I supposed to find this place?
Elodie cries, holding up the note.
I have no idea where I am, let alone where Saint-Henri is. And what if someone tries to bomb it again? It's crazy, isn't it?
I'll come with you, Marie-Claude says. I'll make sure you find it.
Thank you.
You have to get a job right away, she adds. I can't pay the rent on my own.
Elodie nods, feeling overwhelmed.
Do you want to unpack? There's a drawer for you.
Elodie opens her suitcase on the floor and removes her few belongings. All of them fit into the bottom drawer with room to spare.
Are you hungry? Marie-Claude asks her. There's some food in the refrigerator which I'll share with you, until you have money for your own.
The refrigerator. Elodie looks over at the white metal box in the kitchen and remembers being asked by the doctor at Saint Nazarius if she knew what it was. She did not. Marie-Claude jumps up, full of nervous energy, and goes to the kitchen.
I have some leftover pork, she says. And we can boil some potatoes.
Elodie nods mutely.
Come and help.
Elodie reluctantly joins her new roommate in the kitchen. She watches dumbfounded as Marie-Claude fills a pot with water, covers it, and places it on the stove.
This is how you turn the stove on, she explains,
twisting the dial.
Now we peel the potatoes.
She reaches for one of the mismatched knives in the drawer and begins to expertly carve the dirty brown skin off the potato.
Why are you doing that?
Elodie asks her.
Because you don't boil the potato with the skin on.
Why not?
You just don't.
Marie-Claude continues peeling the potatoes. The skin comes off in a perfect coil.
Want to try?
No.
You'll learn all of this stuff, Marie-Claude assures her. I did.
Elodie nods, tears streaming down her cheeks.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. You know what? Never mind this. Let's go out.
Out?
For lunch.
But there are so many people.
Yes, there are people in the world. You can't hide from them.
I'm too scared.
Of what?
Elodie shrugs.
That they'll know.
Know what?
That I've just come out of a mental institution.
Only you and I know that.
I feel like it's stamped on my forehead.
Well, it's not. How much money did Sister Camille give you?
Elodie reaches into her pocket and pulls out a few dollar bills.
We won't use much, Marie-Claude says. 50 cents at most.
Just enough to celebrate. The girls bundle up in their coats, and Marie-Claude loans Elodie her scarf to wrap around her head instead of a toque. They head out into the cold, flinching at the sharp bite of the air against their cheeks. The wind whips around them, and Elodie pulls the scarf up to her eyeballs.
Tabarnak, il fait frais,
Marie-Claude curses. Snow crunches underfoot as they come to the Parc Marguerite Bourgeois. Elodie glances up and notices a group of children running around in their snowsuits, laughing and yelling, playing in the snow. What shocks her most is how free they are. They don't seem to be the least bit afraid to laugh out loud or raise their voices or enjoy themselves. They turn onto Wellington, and the sound of the children's laughter lingers, following Elodie down the street.
Here,
Marie-Claude says, coming to a stop in front of a place that says Paul Patate Frites in the window.
My favorite greasy spoon.
Inside, it's warm and smells like fried oil, the way it did in the cafeteria at Saint-Nazarius, when they served fried perch for special occasions. They stomp their boots to shake off the snow and sit down side by side at the counter, on red leather stools that spin. At first, Elodie worries she might fall off, but soon she's spinning around like a child on a merry-go-round. Marie-Claude orders two stemmes and two Pepsis. Not more than 5 minutes later, the waitress delivers a plate that smells like heaven.
What is this?
She asks Marie-Claude, leaning over it and inhaling the pleasing smell of grease.
That's a hot dog and french fries,
Marie-Claude says. Elodie reaches for a french fry and shoves it in her mouth, not caring that it burns her tongue. She closes her eyes and savors the taste and texture of it, crispy on the outside, mushy inside, perfectly greasy, and then grabs another handful.
Try this,
Marie-Claude says, pouring a glob of red goop from a glass bottle that says Heinz.
Dunk the french fry in the ketchup. That's it.
Mon Dieu,
Elodie gasps, reaching greedily for the hot dog.
It's delicious!
Put ketchup on that too,
Marie-Claude instructs.
Mon Dieu!
Elodie exclaims again, biting into the pink sausage wrapped in a blanket of warm, squishy bread.
Why couldn't they feed us like this at Saint-Nazarius?
This is real food,
Marie-Claude says, her mouth full.
You have ketchup all over your face.
I don't care!
The waitress sets down two glasses of a dark liquid. Elodie puts the straw to her lips and takes a sip to wash down the hot dog.
Oh, mon Dieu,
she repeats, her lips tingling and her tongue fizzing.
It's so sweet.
Pepsi,
Marie-Claude says.
Beautiful, isn't it?
Elodie laughs, delighted.
Yes,
she says, taking another long slurp.
Beautiful.
Chapter 47. Maggie. Maggie sits down on her porch swing with a cup of coffee and her stationery, barefoot and still in her nightgown. The sun is already up, and the air has the lovely, dewy smell of summer mornings. Gabrielle and James are asleep, a rare moment that's nothing short of sacred. If not for the chorus of the magnolia warblers in her yard, it would feel like she had the planet to herself. She pulls out a fresh sheet of paper and her good pen. There's a new premier in office, which means it's a new opportunity to make her case. She starts to write.
Dear Monsieur Bourassa,
I'm writing on behalf of my daughter, Elodie de Saint-Sulpice, an orphan born.
Good morning, my love.
Maggie looks up and Gabrielle is standing in the doorway, hair disheveled, naked but for his briefs. He lights a smoke and comes out onto the porch.
It's warm,
he says, joining her on the wooden swing he built. Maggie sets her letter aside and they rock quietly for a while. Gabrielle reaches for her mug and takes a sip of her coffee.
You're writing Bourassa, aren't you?
Yes.
He nods and she detects a note of pity in his eyes.
Poor bastard, he teases. He has no idea how often he's going to hear from you. He probably wouldn't have run for premier if he'd known.
I know you think she's dead, Maggie says, reiterating the same conversation they have every time she sends one of her letters to the government.
It doesn't matter what I think, he says.
It does to me.
I know you need to believe she's alive, Maggie.
And you?
I just don't think the government is going to help you get her back, he says pragmatically. They're the ones